To the Batmobile. Let's go.
Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
Roger. Ready to move out.
Welcome, everyone, to the Pop Culture King Show, your weekly geeky dose of pop culture and entertainment. And now, ladies and gentlemen, your host, John Waterhouse.
Hey there, back in the studio, fresh off of the Elvis cruise. Probably one of the most amazing pop culture experiences I've ever been a part of. Great music from some of his former bandmates. I got to meet his original drummer from the Sun era and beyond, DJ Fontana. He showed me the diamond horseshoe ring that Elvis gave him. I'm going to be playing that interview on a future episode. I saw plenty of Elvi perform, some of the best Elvis tribute artists going, lots of sideburns, lots of jumpsuits, and a boatload of serious fans. I can't really describe what an interesting exercise and fandom it really was. The Elvis cruise, man, check it out next year.
Thank you very much.
But now onto another big pop culture event, probably one of the biggest and most ambitious concerts touring this year. Pink Floyd co-founder Roger Waters has taken a lavish live version of The Wall on the road. It comes to Atlanta on November 18th. He's going to be pulling out all the stops on this one with all those giant inflatables, a massive wall, pyro, and tons more. Now, all of the visual imagery you'll see on The Wall tour, which can also be found, you know, on the original Pink Floyd album, in the movie The Wall, and elsewhere, it comes from the mind of artist Gerald Scarfe. His artwork has become synonymous with The Wall, and in my late teens, like so many kids of the day, my bedroom was covered in Pink Floyd posters featuring Scarfe's artwork, so it's an honor to have Gerald Scarfe on today's PCK show. He's going to be calling in all the way from England, a political cartoonist, designer, and animator for more than 50 years. Scarfe's got a new book out now called The Making of Pink Floyd's The Wall. Now this, and the fact that the Wall concert is rolling into town, is cause for dedicating the entire PCK show to the Wall. Now when Pink Floyd released the Wall in 1979, a tour followed, but the show was so huge it only took place in really a handful of cities. The band actually lost money on the deal. So that's one of the reasons the current tour is such a big event. With the exception of Roger Waters' big Berlin Wall production in 1990, it really hasn't been done since. So I'm going to start the show with a track from the original live production of The Wall. It comes from the album Is There Anybody Out There? The Wall Live, 1980-1981. This is Pink Floyd with In the Flesh on the Pop Culture King Show.
Thank you.
tuned into the Pop Culture King Show, your weekly geeky dose of pop culture and entertainment. I am John Waterhouse on AM 1690, The Voice of the Arts. That was Pink Floyd with In the Flesh from Is There Anybody Out There? The Wall, live 1980 to 1981. Floyd co-founder Roger Waters is bringing his ginormous production of The Wall to Phillips Arena on November 18th, and all of that artwork and imagery you see associated with all forms of The Wall comes from artist Gerald Scarf. He's our special guest on this week's episode dedicated to The Wall. But right now, it's the time we check in with various pop culture happenings. It's the pop culture poop, the news, the don't stink. Pitchfork.com recently reported that former Nirvana drummer and current Foo Fighters leader Dave Grohl is going to be reuniting with his former Nirvana bandmate, bassist Chris Novoselic. Novoselic will be guesting on bass on the new Foo Fighters disc. Butch Vig, who produced Nirvana's landmark album Nevermind, he's going to be overseeing things. In an interview with Radio 1, Grohl revealed that there will be 14 tracks on the record and not one acoustic guitar. The production, he says, is, quote, totally old school analog. Grohl also says they're making a documentary about the creation of the album. Fans of late 80s nostalgia can dust off their flight suits. New York Magazine's online entertainment section Vulture reported that Paramount and Skydance Productions are developing a sequel to the 1986 Tom Cruise flick Top Gun. The script is going to be written by Christopher McQuarrie, who won an Oscar for The Usual Suspects. Now, earlier reports about Top Gun 2 said the character of Maverick, played by Cruise, was only going to have a small role. But McQuarrie told Vulture that, quote, there is no Top Gun 2 in which Maverick is not the starring role. In more music news, last year the Beastie Boys were preparing to release its album Hot Sauce Committee Part 1 when band member Adam Yauch had to have emergency surgery for a cancerous tumor. The band recently announced on its website that the album is going to be delayed indefinitely, but Hot Sauce Committee Part 2 is going to be released in spring of 2011. Pretty strange, but once again, proof there are no rules in rock and roll.
Oh yeah!
And now for DVD and Blu-ray releases for November 16th. Jim Carrey gets animated in Disney's A Christmas Carol. The Kids Are All Right, not the awesome family radio show on AM 1690, but the acclaimed drama starring Annette Bening, Julianne Moore, and Mark Ruffalo hits stores. Same goes for M. Night Shyamalan-Ding-Dong's The Last Airbender. Sci-fi fans should be salivating for Metropolis, the complete Metropolis. The Night of the Hunter gets the Criterion treatment, and Charlie Brown keeps on celebrating with the Peanuts Deluxe Holiday Collection. Stay with us, artist Gerald Scarf, the guy responsible for the imagery surrounding Pink Floyd's The Wall, is up next. It's the Pop Culture King Show, AM 1690, The Voice of the Arts.
Hello, this is Anthony Daniels. You're listening to the Pop Culture King Show on AM 1690, where the Force will be with you always.
Back with you, the Pop Culture King Show, your weekly geeky dose of pop culture and entertainment. We're dedicating this week's show to Roger Waters' The Wall Live Tour. It lands in Atlanta on November 18th at Phillips Arena. And we got a few stats about the tour. Now, the actual wall that's going to be built on stage during the show, the length of it is 240 feet wide. It's more than 35 feet high and 18 feet deep. the number of bricks in the wall, 424. The number placed during the show is 242. The build time, which is the length of time from placing the first brick to the last brick, is 45 minutes. There's a crew of 12 touring wall builders, and 8 local crew members are going to be helping build the wall. Now, someone who's had a huge hand in building the wall project itself is artist Gerald Scarfe. Now, although Roger Waters provided the story, lyrics, and much of the music, the imagery that you see is all Gerald Scarfe. Scarfe designed the wall's album art, designed and directed the animation for the subsequent 1982 film, and provided art and design for the wall's current live production. You can read all about it in his latest book, The Making of Pink Floyd's The Wall, from DeCapo Press. He's been a political cartoonist for more than 50 years. Other career highlights include serving as the production designer on the Disney animated feature Hercules. Now please welcome a guy whose artwork was all over my teenage bedroom wall, the great Gerald Scarfe.
Hi, John. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much for taking time to speak with me today.
No, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure.
So you've been drawing political cartoons for more than 50 years. More than 40 years for the London Sunday Times. You've also worked with The New Yorker. Now, it's one thing to write a political editorial, but it seems with illustrations, you can arguably say much more with a visual medium. Can you explain your personal take on political cartooning?
Well, political cartooning, I think, has to be very, very simple. It has to deliver its message immediately. And unlike an article, you can't say on the one hand this and on the other hand that. You've got to go for one side or the other. You've got to be black or white about the whole question. And I think that that means that you've got to hit the reader between the eyes. If you think of a newspaper, it's got, I don't know how many illustrations in it. It's got headlines grabbing your attention. It's got skillfully designed advertisements. They're all vying for your attention. So the cartoonist has to sort of get up to that level and hit hard and get the message across quickly.
A great description of your political cartooning came from the late George Melly, and I read this off of your website, and it says, quote, "At times distorting his subjects' features to the point of incoherence, dragging out their brains, hearts, and entrails to demonstrate their corruption of spirit." I think that's so poetic and such a great description.
Well, that's very flattering, yes. I mean, I feel in many ways I do like to dissemble the face, take it apart, throw it up in the air and let it fall back and see what I've got. And also, I describe sometimes cartooning like a piece of chewing gum. You know, you can stretch the features and as much as you possibly can, but ultimately the chewing gum snaps and the likeness goes. But because it's so boring drawing these politicians over and over again, I think an artist has to make something interesting for himself. He has to sort of try and make it more interesting than it is. So my drawings are not necessarily little, small drawings like small photographs. They are wherever I can. I take the nose as far as I can. I stretch the neck. I stretch whatever I can, really. I don't have a lot of respect for politicians, really. I mean, I often think, who are these arrogant guys who get up there and say, you know, this is the way to go. I'll solve your problems for you. I mean, I know it's necessary evil, but I don't have any brief for them. So I've spent my life, really, you know, the past 50 years, as you say, being extremely rude to people. That's how I've made my living.
I mean, have you had any sort of response from some of these politicians? I mean, Tony Blair really resembles, your version of Tony Blair resembles this crouching rodent, and George Bush has these primate-like characteristics. I mean, have you got any sort of response from any of these guys?
Well, I think the truth is, in a way, with these guys, of course, it's beneath their dignity to mention that they've even been, on the other hand, also, sometimes these politicians write to ask for the original of these drawings, which means, in a way, I'm not hitting them as hard enough. They're so arrogant and thick-skinned that they would rather have a drawing depicting them as a pig than not appear at all. You know, it's all exposure for them. But, I mean, your question about do they ever respond, the only thing I can think of is sometimes the fans respond. And I remember I made a drawing of Mick Jagger back in the 60s. And 114 schoolgirls from the school, I think it was 3 classes, wrote to me, and they all signed it personally, and they said, "Dear Mr. Scarfe, for what you've done to our Mick, we're going to get you and cut your balls off. And they never got me. But, I mean, the thing that got me was that they all signed it, you know. Jane this and Janet that and Elizabeth this. And then they said, "Yours sincerely" at the end, too, which I thought was a nice touch.
You're tuned into the Pop Culture King Show, and we're continuing our conversation with artist Gerald Scarfe, who provides all of the imagery for Roger Waters' The Wall live tour, and he's also the author of The Making of Pink Floyd's The Wall. So you've also done war correspondence in the past, and, you know, a photographer has the luxury of capturing an image instantly. But as an illustrator, what sort of techniques did you use to capture the elements of war?
Well, I went to the Vietnam War, yeah, and I was there. And, of course, I was traveling with photographers who, as you say, can click and run, but I was still sharpening my pencils while the bullets were whistling. And I suppose, really, being a war correspondent as an artist is now an outmoded thing. We have such excellent kind of movies, movie cameras and instant digital pictures which they can send back home. I mean, the advantage really, I suppose, about being an artist is that you can assemble different incidents into one picture. You don't have to have an actuality there. But then, of course, these days, neither do cameramen with their digital cameras. They can add stuff, they can do what they like with it.
So did your experiences in Vietnam influence or even maybe set the stage for some of the war imagery in Pink Floyd's The Wall, some of the war animation?
Very much so. I mean, I up until I went to Vietnam, I had been drawing war pictures. I mean, I've always been anti-war, naturally. I'd been taking my information from the TV and from newspapers. And at that time, back in the 70s, all of the pictures from Vietnam were kind of gung-ho. You know, like John Wayne type guys leaping out of airplanes, helicopters, and with the rotor blades fanning and the dust blowing. They looked almost romantic, like out of a movie. Of course, when you get there, you find it's nothing like that at all. And the young American guys, they're 19, 20, 21. They've all been pulled out of their high schools and out of their universities and flown across the ocean, you know, to this land of thousands of miles away and told to kill the gooks, as they called them. Euphemistically, they called them the gooks to dehumanize them. And these are just poor kids, you know, and I was amongst them, and I made drawings of some very sad drawings of them. And on the other side were the Vietnamese people, who are in many ways some of the most gentle people in the world. I mean, they just, like most people, want to get on with their lives, have their families, and be left alone. Anyway, Vietnam was a huge mistake, I felt, and I made drawings against it from the very moment. But your question about, you know, did this affect the wall? Yes, of course it did. And the other thing that affected the wall was that I was born during or before the Second World War here in Britain, and therefore I lived through the bombs falling on London. And although I was very young then, I could sense, I guess, my parents' fear. You never knew what was going to happen, and there was that feeling of anxiety everywhere. And that, plus the fact that I was a severely asthmatic child, gave me a very kind of timid, frightened upbringing. And I think drawing at that point became my way of expressing myself on paper, you know, explaining the crazy world to myself. And I think it's still like that now. So when I came to do The Wall, of course, especially in pieces like Goodbye Blue Skies, I was able to do a kind of visual poem to war, to Second World War, the sadness of war, the planes flying over and turning into crosses, and the Union Jack, the English flag, planted in the ground, sort of falling apart and just bleeding into the ground, and all the blood from the Union Jack going down the drain, you know, pointing out the uselessness of war. You know, like all artists, my experiences go into my work.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control. No dark sarcasm in the classroom.
Hi, this is Gene Simmons, and you're listening to the Pop Culture King Show. But you knew that.
Welcome back, Pop Culture King Show. Our show this week is dedicated to Roger Waters' The Wall Live Tour coming to Atlanta on November 18th at Phillips Arena. Big pop culture medicine. The entire production weighs in at approximately 112 tons. And our special guest is the guy who's been providing all of the Wall-related artwork since the late 70s. We're talking with Gerald Scarfe. And speaking of your work and your association with Pink Floyd, it dates back several years before The Wall. You provided concert animation and illustrations for the band and that sort of stuff before. Can you talk about how you first connected with the band?
I made a film here for the BBC, and I was sent to Los Angeles to work on what was thought to be a new animation system. It turned out not to be. But anyway, while I was there, I thought I should make a kind of stream of consciousness about what I knew about America at the time and what I saw in America. I made drawings, one morphing into the other, of the things that were happening at the time, like, you know, Statue of Liberty, Frank Sinatra, Mickey Mouse, Playboy magazine, mm-hmm. John Wayne, and Black Power, and the space projects and so on. So it was all of these images was sort of morphing one into the other. And when this was played on the BBC, apparently Nick Mason saw it. And he rang up Roger and said, "Did you see like that last night?" And Roger said, "Yeah, I saw it." He said, "We've got to have this guy on board. He's f***ing mad. We've got to have him on board." So that was my credentials for joining the Floyd. And then after that, they got me to work on Wish You Were Here. And I just made bits of film, which I delivered to their gigs. The next thing, I guess, was that Roger came to me with the finished tapes of The Wall that he'd sung himself into a synthesizer, to a synthesizer. And played them in front of me. I remember when he came here to my house, where I'm speaking from now in Chelsea, he played me these tapes, and it was very, very difficult when you listen to something that someone's been spending like 2 years or whatever it was in writing and so forth to show the right amount of appreciation when it finished. And when it finished the tapes, it was kind of like an awkward silence. And I said, "Oh, yeah, that's great, that's great." And Roger said, "You know, I feel as though I just pulled my pants down and shit in front of you." He felt that vulnerable, you know.
Right.
About all his work was being just judged in that moment by me. He said, "Hey, that's fine." But thereafter, Roger and I decided that it would be an album, a show, and a movie. And it's to his credit that he pulled all of those three off. And I worked with him during that whole period, and that's what I've recorded in this book, the period of how we put this show together. It's like the creation of what has become a classic piece now, almost a rock opera. And I've chronicled, you know, the difficulties that happened, not only between me and Alan Parker, but between me, between the band, between David and Roger. And there was a hell of a lot of infighting going on at that time. The band was splitting up. And so it was a tough thing to work on, the movie, I must say. It was a very, very tough thing to work on. And I found myself driving, I remember one morning at about 9 o'clock in the morning, to Pinewood Studios here in Britain, where the film was finished. And I had a bottle of Jack Daniels on the passenger seat. And I'm not a heavy drinker, but I felt that I had to have a slug before I went in the morning, because I knew what was coming, you know. I just needed that little fortification before I went in.
So the book you're speaking of is The Making of Pink Floyd's The Wall, recently published here. We received it in America in October. Now, Roger Waters has a reputation for having a very strong creative vision. What sort of dynamic do you guys have together?
He has always been extremely supportive. And the great thing about Roger, and he told me this, is that when you hire an artist, you don't hire that artist to change what they do. You accept what they do, or you get rid of them. And Roger was always very, very open to whatever I suggested. My job, of course, is to interpret his vision, interpret his lyrics, interpret his music. But naturally, it's my interpretation. It's not his. And so when he says, you know, when he writes about these forces of oppression, I have to find something that symbolizes the forces of oppression. And I couldn't think of anything more strong and frightening and cruel and unrelentingly cruel than a hammer. And so, you know, the hammers, I designed the hammers and the marching hammers, and that, you know, was my interpretation of Rogers' fear of fascism, really. Then there was the little figure of Pink. Everything has to, you know, everything has to come out of my head, really. The visual side has to come out of my head. This doesn't mean that Rogers didn't have any input. He certainly did, and he was always very, very supportive. But the kind of way of doing it is that I read his stuff, and we kind of talk things over about how the movie would go. Then I would make a number of drawings, which I would stick onto my studio wall. He and Alan Parker would come and discuss the images and see which way they would go. Sometimes we'd change the images around, put this one there and that one there. And that was how the whole thing happened. But in writing this book, I've realized just, in a way, it's not Roger's vision, it's mine. I mean, it is Roger's vision initially, but then, of course, the images have to come out of my head, and therefore they're probably my reactions.
this is Larry Hagman, and you're listening to the Pop Culture King Show. You're going to love it.
You just heard Pink Floyd with a live version of Young Lust. And this week we're talking with the legendary Gerald Scarfe, the artist who's been providing the imagery for the Wall project since the late 70s. Now, can you talk about some of the things that you lent to the new production of the Wall?
Well, one of the main problems was to adapt my animation to this huge wall, which built across the arena is much bigger than the original shows. And I was designing them for the Pink Floyd's famous circular screen. So we had to find ways of augmenting these things. And when it came to the marching hammers, they wanted to march right across the wall, you know, not just a screen in the middle, what they call academy-sized screen, which is the regular screen that you would see in a movie house. You need three times that width, really. So a lot of it was to do with adapting that on the computer and so on, which we talked about, but I myself didn't do because I didn't do the computer work, but they just took my original work and spread it. I did a lot of graffiti, which I wrote on the wall. Roger found this piece by Dwight Eisenhower, which he liked very much, which in effect says, every tank, every gun, every plane made steals from the needy in the world, the starving and the poor, because every bit of money you spend on that takes it away from their mouths. So I would write these in my handwriting, and those are on the wall. And I also particularly myself wanted to remake the inflatable figures, because the others, which were done way back in the 1980s, were a little unsophisticated. And so the new figures can move better. They are more articulated. Their limbs move. The mother's head will swivel and she can rock her arms and so on. So it was just kind of, you know, it's the same piece, obviously, and the same music, and it's just a great opportunity for those who've never seen the wall to see it. I mean, the original production was only shown in, Los Angeles, New York, Dortmund, and London, I think. So it's very few people who saw the theatrical production. Many, many people, many millions, have seen the Wall movie, so they know it only from the movie.
The memories. The madness. The music. The movie. The Wall.
We don't need no education.
It'll be interesting for them to go back and see where the whole thing started. Because it's grown as it goes. And the movie had lots of live-action shots, obviously, that had to be added to it, whereas the theatrical piece, the concert, the opera, is quite a different genre. And so it's an interesting thing for them. And now as Roger's playing the whole of America back and forth, many, many millions more are going to have to be able to see it. And same in Europe. Next year, he's playing Europe in the spring.
Well, what's so fascinating to me is the fact that this work still has so much relevance today with what's going on. I mean, he's talking about the current political climate, and it's also both politically and emotionally and musically touching an entire new generation. I mean, it continues to. And that's fantastic. I mean, what else more would you want with art?
Nothing more, really. I mean, that's a sort of credit to its ability, as you say, to be a classic piece. I remember when I first was promoting The Wall back in the 80s, you know, and the movie came out, and this guy said to me, he said, "Wow, you worked on The Wall?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Whoa, did it change your life?" And I said, "No, not really. It was like another job." "Whoa, sure changed mine." So I think in many ways it hit a nerve.
Hello, is there anybody in there? Just not if you can hear me. Is there anyone at home? Well, I can ease your pain and get you on your feet again. Relax, relax, relax. I need some information, please. Just the basic facts. Can you show me where it hurts? There is no pain.
That was Roger Waters with guest vocals by none other than Van Morrison on a live version of Comfortably Numb. That comes from the album Roger Waters The Wall Live in Berlin. It was originally released in 1990, and that was the last time Waters performed The Wall live. And right now, he's touring a huge live production of The Wall. Hey man, that's all we got for this week's Pop Culture King Show and our special episode dedicated to Roger Waters' The Wall Live, coming to Atlanta very shortly. It was a true pleasure having artist Gerald Scarfe on this week's show. Super cool stuff is always happening on the PCK Show, 8 p.m. Fridays and 10 a.m. Saturdays, only here on AM 1690, The Voice of the Arts, online at www.1690wmlb.com, and on iTunes in the podcast section. Now make sure you become a fan of AM 1690, The Voice of the Arts on Facebook. All of the Pop Culture King shows are listed on there. You can listen to them right there from the comfort of Facebook. I'm your host, John Waterhouse, and we'll catch you next time on the Pop Culture King Show.
I'll be back.